Chapter 15. Philandering since the object of it was gone, angry with herself for having suffered from it so much in the past, furious at its having been all in vain. But she was reasonable enough not to quarrel with him finally. What was the good? She found means to placate him. The only means. As long as there was some money to be got, as he had hold of him. I'll go away. We shall do no good by any more of this sort of talk. I want to be alone for a bit. He went away, sulkily acquiescent. There was a room always kept ready for him on the same floor, at the further end of a short, thickly carpeted passage. How she passed the night, this woman with no illusions, to help her through the hours which must have been sleepless, I shouldn't like to say. It ended at last. And this strange victim of the DeBarrel failure, whose name would never be known to the official receiver, came down to breakfast, impenetrable in her everyday perfection. From the very first, somehow, as he had accepted the fatal news for true. All her life as he had never believed in her luck, with that pessimism of the passionate who at bottom feel themselves to be the outcasts of a morally restrained universe. But this did not make it any easier, on opening the morning paper feverishly, to see the thing confirmed. Oh yes. It was there. The orb but suspended payment, the first growl of the storm faint as yet, but to the initiated the forerunner of a deluge. As an item of news it was not indecently displayed. It was not displayed at all in a sense. The serious paper, the only one of the great dailies which had always maintained an attitude of reserve towards the DeBarrel group of banks, had its scanner. Yes. A modest item of news. But there was also, on another page, a special financial article in a hostile tone beginning with the words, "E have always feared and a guarded," half-column leader, opening with the phrase, "T is a deplorable sign of the times." What was, in effect, an austere, general rebuke to the absurd infatuations of the investing public. She glanced through these articles, a line here and a line there. No more was necessary to catch beyond doubt the murmur of the oncoming flood. Several slighting references by name to DeBarrel revived her animosity against the man, suddenly, as by the effect of unforeseen moral support. "The miserable wretch, dot, you understand," Marlowe interrupted the current of his narrative, "that in order to be consecutive in my relation of this affair, I am telling you at once the details which I heard from Mrs. Fine later in the day, as well as what little Fine imparted to me with his usual solemnity during that morning call. As you may easily guess, the Fines, in their apartments, had read the news at the same time, and, as a matter of fact, in the same august and highly moral newspaper, as the governess in the luxurious mansion a few doors down on the opposite side of the street. But they read them with different feelings. They were thunderstruck. Fine had to explain the full purport of the intelligence to Mrs. Fine, whose first cry was that of relief. Then that poor child would be safe from these designing, horrid people. Mrs. Fine did not know what it might mean to be suddenly reduced from riches to absolute penury. Fine, with his masculine imagination, was less inclined to rejoice extravagantly at the girl's escape from the moral dangers which had been menacing her defenseless existence. It was a confoundedly big price to pay. What an unfortunate little thing she was! He might be able to do something to comfort that poor child at any rate for the time she is here, said Mrs. Fine. She felt under a sort of moral obligation not to be indifferent. But no comfort for anyone could be got by rushing out into the street at this early hour, and so, following the advice of Fine not to act hastily, they both sat down at the window and stared feelingly at the great house, awful to their eyes in its stolid, prosperous, expensive respectability, with ruin absolutely standing at the door. By that time, or very soon after, all Brighton at the information, and formed a more or less just appreciation of its gravity. The butler in Miss DeBarrel's big house had seen the news, perhaps earlier than anybody within a mile of the parade, in the course of his morning duties, of which one was to dry the freshly delivered paper before the fire and occasion to glance at it which no intelligent man could have neglected. He communicated to the rest of the household his vaguely forcible impression that something had gone deeply wrong with the affairs of her father in London. This brought an atmosphere of constraint through the house, which Flora DeBarrel, coming down somewhat later than usual, could not help noticing in her own way. Everybody seemed to stare so stupidly somehow, she feared a dull day. In the dining room, the governess in her place, a newspaper half concealed under the cloth on her lap, after a few words exchanged with lips that seemed hardly to move, remaining motionless, her eyes fixed before her in an enduring silence, and presently Charlie coming in, to whom she did not even give a glance. He hardly said good morning, though he had a half-hearted try to smile at the girl, and sitting opposite her with his eyes on his plate, and slight quivers passing along the line of his clean-shaven jaw, he too had nothing to say. It was dull, horribly dull to begin one's day like this, but she knew what it was. These never-ending family affairs. It was not for the first time that S.E. had suffered from their depressing after-effects on these two. It was a shame that the delightful Charlie should be made dull by these stupid talks, and it was perfectly stupid of him to let himself be upset like this by his aunt. When after a period of still, as if calculating, immobility, her governess got up abruptly and went out with the paper in her hand, almost immediately afterwards followed by Charlie, who left his breakfast half-eaten, the girl was positively relieved. They would have it out that morning whatever it was, and be themselves again in the afternoon. At least Charlie would be. To the moods of her governess she did not attach so much importance. For the first time that morning the fine saw the front door of the awful house open, and the objectionable young man issue forth, his rascality visible to their prejudiced eyes, in his very bowler hat and in the smart cut of his short fawn overcoat. He walked away rapidly like a man hurrying to catch a train, glancing from side to side, as though he were carrying something off. Could he be departing for good? Undoubtedly, undoubtedly. But Mrs. Fine's fervent thank-goodness turned out to be a bit, as the Americans, some Americans say, revious. In a very short time the odious fellow appeared again, strolling, absolutely strolling back, his hat now tilted a little on one side, with an air of leisure and satisfaction. Mrs. Fine groaned, not only in the spirit, at this sight, but in the flesh, audibly, and asked her husband what it might mean. Fine naturally couldn't say. Mrs. Fine believed that there was something horrid in progress, and meantime the object of her detestation had gone up the steps and had knocked at the door which at once opened to admit him. He had been only as far as the bank. His reason for leaving his breakfast unfinished to run after Miss DeBarrel's governess was to speak to her in reference to that very errand possessing the utmost possible importance in his eyes. He shrugged his shoulders at the nervousness of her eyes and hands, at the half-strangled whisper had to go out. I could hardly contain myself. That was her affair. He was, with a young man's squeamishness, rather sick of her ferocity. He did not understand it. Men do not accumulate hate against each other in tiny amounts, treasuring every pinch carefully till it grows at last into a monstrous and explosive hoard. He had run out after her to remind her of the balance at the bank. What about lifting that money without wasting any more time? As he had promised him to leave nothing behind. An account opened in her name for the expenses of the establishment in Brighton had been fed by DeBarrel with deferential lavishness. The governess crossed the wide hall into a little room at the side, where she sat down to write the check, which he hastened out to go and cash as if it were stolen or a forgery. As observed by the Fines, his uneasy appearance on leaving the house arose from the fact that his first trouble having been caused by a check of doubtful authenticity, the possession of a document of the sort made him unreasonably uncomfortable till this one was safely cashed. And after all, you know it was stealing of an indirect sort, for the money was DeBarrel's money, if the account was in the name of the accomplished lady. At any rate, the check was cashed. On getting hold of the notes and gold, he recovered his jaunty bearing, it being well known that with certain natures the presence of money, even stolen, in the pocket, acts as a tonic, or at least as a stimulant. He cocked his hat a little on one side, as though he had had a drink, or two, which indeed he might have had in reality, to celebrate the occasion. The governess had been waiting for his return in the hall, disregarding the side glances of the butler as he went in, and out of the dining room clearing away the breakfast things. It was she, herself, who had opened the door so promptly. "Tea's all right," he said, touching his breast pocket, and she did not dare, the miserable wretch without illusions, she did not dare ask him to hand it over. They looked at each other in silence. He nodded significantly. "Where is she now?" And she whispered one into the drawing room. "Want to see her again?" With an archly black look which he acknowledged by a muttered, surly, "I'm damned if I do." "Well, as you want to bolt like this, why don't we go now?" She set her lips with cruel obstinacy, and shook her head. As he had her idea, her completed plan. At that moment the Fines, still at the window and watching like a pair of private detectives, saw a man with a long gray beard and a jovial face go up the steps helping himself with a thick stick and knock at the door. Who could he be? He was one of Mr. Barrel's masters. As he had lately taken up painting in watercolors, having read in a high-class woman's weekly paper that a great many princesses of the European royal houses were cultivating that art. This was the watercolor morning, and the teacher, a veteran of many exhibitions, of a venerable and jovial aspect, had turned up with his usual punctuality. He was no great reader of morning papers, and even had he seen the news, it is very likely he would not have understood its real purport. At any rate, he turned up, as the governess expected him to do, and the Fine saw him pass through the fateful door. He bowed cordially to the lady in charge of Mr. Barrel's education, whom he saw in the hall engaged in conversation with a very good-looking, but somewhat raffish young gentleman. She turned to him graciously. "Laura's already waiting for you in the drawing room." The cultivation of the art said to be patronized by princesses was pursued in the drawing room from considerations of the right kind of light. The governess preceded the master up the stairs and into the room where Mr. Barrel was found arrayed in a holland pinafore, also of the right kind for the pursuit of the art, and smilingly expectant. The watercolor lesson enlivened by the jocular conversation of the kindly, humorous, old man was always great fun, and she felt she would be compensated for the tiresome beginning of the day. Her governess generally was present at the lesson, but on this occasion she only sat down till the master and pupil had gone to work in earnest, and then, as though as he had suddenly remembered some order to give, rose quietly and went out of the room. Once outside, the servants summoned by the passing maid without a bell being rung, and "Quick, quick, let all this luggage be taken down into the hall, and let one of you call a cab." She stood outside the drawing room door on the landing, looking at each piece, trunk, leather cases, portmanteaus, being carried past her, her brows knitted and her aspect so somber and absorbed that it took some little time for the butler to muster courage enough to speak to her. But he reflected that he was a free-born Briton and had his rights. He spoke straight to the point, but in the usual respectful manner. "Beg you pardon, ma'am, but are you going away for good?" He was startled by her tone. Its unexpected, unladylike harshness fell on his trained ear with the disagreeable effect of a false note. "Yes, I am going away. And the best thing for all of you is to go away too, as soon as you like. You can go now, today, this moment. You had your wages paid you only last week. The longer you stay, the greater your loss. But I have nothing to do with it now. You are the servants of Mr. De Barrel, you know." The butler was astounded by the manner of this advice, and as his eyes wandered to the drawing room door, the governess extended her arm, as if to bar the way. "Nobody goes in there. and that was said still in another tone, such a tone, that all trace of the trained respectfulness vanished from the butler's bearing. He stared at her with a frank, wondering gaze. "Ah, till I am gone," she added, and there was such an expression on her face that the man was daunted by the mystery of it. He shrugged his shoulders slightly, and without another word, went down the stairs on his way to the basement, brushing in the hall past Mr. Charles, who had on head, and both hands rammed deep into his overcoat pockets, paced up and down, as though on sentry duty there. The lady's maid was the only servant upstairs, hovering in the passage on the first floor, curious and as if fascinated by the woman who stood there guarding the door. Being beckoned closer imperiously, and asked by the governess to bring out of the now empty rooms the hat and veil, the only objects besides the furniture still to be found there, she did so in silence but inwardly fluttered. And while waiting uneasily, with the veil, before that woman who, without moving a step away from the drawing room door, was pinning with careless haste her hat on her head, she heard within a sudden burst of laughter from Miss DeBarrel, enjoying the fun of the watercolor lesson given her for the last time by the cheery old man. Mr. and Mrs. Fine ambushed at their window, a most incredible occupation for people of their kind, saw with renewed anxiety a cab come to the door, and watched some luggage being carried out and put on its roof. The butler appeared for a moment, then went in again. What did it mean? Was Flora going to be taken to her father, or were these people, that woman and her horrible nephew, about to carry her off somewhere? Fine couldn't tell. He doubted the last, Flora having now, he judged, no value, either positive or speculative. Though no great reader of character, he did not credit the governess with humane intentions. He confessed to me naively that he was excited, as if watching some action on the stage. Then the thought struck him that the girl might have had some money settled on her, be possessed of some means, of some little fortune of her own, and therefore, he imparted this theory to his wife, who shared fully his consternation. "Can't believe the child will go away without running in to say goodbye to us," she murmured. "He must find out. I shall ask her." But at that very moment the cab rolled away, empty inside, and the door of the house, which had been standing slightly ajar till then, was pushed to. They remained silent, staring at it, till Mrs. Fine whispered doubtfully, "Really think I must go over." Fine didn't answer for a while, his is a reflective mind, you know, and then, as if Mrs. Fine's whispers had an occult power over that door, it opened wide again, and the white-bearded man issued, astonishingly active in his movements, using his stick almost like a leaping pole, to get down the steps, and hobbled away briskly along the pavement. Naturally, the Fines were too far off to make out the expression of his face, but it would not have helped them very much to a guess at the conditions inside the house. The expression was humorously puzzled, nothing more. For, at the end of his lesson, seizing his trusty stick and coming out with his habitual vivacity, he very nearly cannoned just outside the drawing room door into the back of Miss DeBarrel's governess. He stopped himself in time, and she turned round swiftly. It was embarrassing, he apologized. But her face was not startled. It was not aware of him. It wore a singular expression of resolution. A very singular expression which, as it were, detained him for a moment. In order to cover his embarrassment, he made some inane remark on the weather, upon which, instead of returning another inane remark according to the tacit rules of the game, she only gave him a smile of unfathomable meaning. Nothing could have been more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.